session number 28624, Reel 8.
Recording number 2 in the fourth session. So that was the drills. We spoke about the patrols. You also mentioned the last time that we were speaking that you did riot drills, that you practiced these. Will you describe to us, please, how you did that?
Yes, in the event of riot building up, or crowds, I should say, building up and potentially becoming violent and rioting, the police would call for military aid, and a platoon would be sent up, perhaps one platoon up front with another platoon back up, whatever the company commander decided was necessary. And what you would be doing, your drill was, and this is what we were rehearsing all the time in camp, a platoon would march up, it would make its approach towards the crowd. The platoon commander would decide where he wanted to debus, get out of his vehicle, some distance from the crowd. You don't drive right up into the crowd or even too close to them. You get off at an appropriate distance, whatever that is, the length of a street, half the length of a street, 200 yards, whatever. You debus and you form up in your three ranks. And you know, you have the sort of bannermen at the front, you have your bugler, you're all armed, of course, and then you march in a very precise military phalanx sort of mode and approach the crowd, stop. The crowd's attention will be diverted from whatever it was before, because it now sees a military force there, and it'll come towards it out of curiosity, or it'll just stay where it is, in which case you'll advance a little more until you have the eye of the crowd, so to speak. You have become the focus of attention. You then put your tape man, run out, set a tape across the street from side to side, and that becomes the sort of boundary. You're really confronting them, and that becomes a boundary, and any man who crosses that is encroaching upon you, and this is something you'll be telling them. You also have your banner telling them, you know, to go back or do this or do that. If they are not concentrating sufficiently on you, you have a bugler who will always attract the attention of people at the back, and you have then got their focus. You then, this is a riot drill situation, and there they are, will be starting to listen to you, to take orders from you, to disperse, do whatever. And of course, you know, your policeman is there with you. He'll be making announcements too in Swahili or whatever, and you know, you have taken control of a situation. Now that is what you're training to do the whole time. The patrols I described before were quite separate things. There was no riot, there was no confrontation, you were just being seen. But this is in the event of a potentially violent situation where a crowd gathers. And that's what your training's all about.
Okay. And you mentioned there bannermen, and you also mentioned banners. Were they carrying these banners?
Yes, they were. You don't put the banners up until you have set out your tape over which no man must cross, and you know, your banner will be ordering them to disperse or whatever, and it'll be written in the language that's appropriate to the corner of the world you're operating in. But as you approach, the banner's not up. The soldiers will be carrying the banner furled rather than unfurled. It's on the word of command from you that the banner is then hoisted and the message is displayed.
And were these large banners?
Yes, they were, yes. Oh, yeah. Very legible from 50 yards or distance or whatever.
Okay, and was it made of material or
yes,
something?
Yes, Hessian, really. Yes, just sackcloth. Yeah, really two poles and joined together by this Hessian. So one soldier would be holding a pole there, the other 3 yards away would be holding the other, and the pole and the banner would be an Hessian with whatever the message was.
Okay. And the men that were carrying these banner poles, would they have been covered by someone else in case anything happened?
Absolutely. They would be displaying that from within the ranks. Because they were hoisting it above their heads, they didn't have to move forward. The only people who moved forward were those two who were running out to lay the tape across the road, and they would immediately get back into their position within the platoon. The two banner men would be holding the banner from their position within the ranks, and then they'd be lowering it. They didn't keep this up for longer than was necessary, just to give everyone an opportunity to see what it said. And they would, yes, we were all in this sort of solid three rank platoon of 30 men.
Okay, and nowadays we would expect men who were going into that situation to be in riot gear. Were you in riot gear?
Yes, we certainly were. We had the shield. We had shields, and you would wear helmets, and yes, we had batons. We had everything else. But yes, I think probably from today's riot gear, it really hasn't changed much. The shields were doubtless made of something stronger and more durable today than they were then, but basically it's a shield and baton situation.
And were you ever in a riot situation?
No.
In
no, we were. I think the closest we got to it was on one day that I think we received some word that a crowd might be gathering, but in fact it was very, I think it turned out we were then on alert within the camp. But we weren't called out because I think it was a particular festive day, whether it was a holy day or a holiday of some sort. But the crowd did gather, but apparently they had done every year, and this was a very peaceful gathering, and the last thing you would do is send military in, because that might provoke a few hotheads. No requirement for us at all, so. That, I think, was about as near as we came to being called out.
Okay. And was there an area within the camp that you could practice this?
Yes, absolutely. We didn't have a square, but we had a very firm driveway, a short driveway, about 50 yards worth from memory, from the Aga Khan bungalow to a sort of gate, a perimeter area, and it was where we formed up every day for a muster parade, where all our parades were held, and there was nothing more than it wouldn't have been broad enough to allow 2-3 tonners to pass, but it was broad enough, and that was a perfectly good place, because it was hard ground, and you were able to sort of drill on it, so to speak. Otherwise, you were grass or beach.
And within this tented camp as well, we spoke about it last week, do you know if there was any preparations or plans in case you were attacked? I remember you saying it wasn't enclosed.
That's right. No, it wasn't enclosed. No, I mean, we never felt under threat anyway, but I know what you mean. And someone could have attacked, and it would have been difficult for them because we had no perimeter walls or fences or barbed wire. But the very fact that we patrolled it day and night made it secure. I mean, it was beach on one side and therefore the sea, but that doesn't mean to say anyone couldn't have come in from there. But and it was just grassland on the other side all around, but open, and we were vulnerable, certainly, but the fact that we patrolled it all the time, we could have been alerted within seconds.
Okay. And whilst you were in camp as well, did you manage to keep up your training, like a training that you'd done back in the UK?
No, we didn't. Our role was such that it was an internal security one, so it really was just patrolling and riot drill, and we didn't even attempt to train for our role back in Kenya, where we were on standby for an invasion of Kuwait. So our training up there would have been totally different and much more in line with the training I was used to at cadet school. This was quite different, and it occupied all our time anyway. There wasn't time. And the island actually didn't allow you to train. There was no open terrain or anything like that. There were no training areas, of course. But it wasn't open country such as Kenya provided.
Okay. Was there rifle ranges or anything you could go to?
Not at all. No, there were no ranges, and I'm absolutely sure of that. No, that was all done in Kenya.
Okay. We spoke as well about recreation, about going to the clubs and things. Was there anywhere that you could maybe have a game of football or rugby or anything?
Yes, we certainly did. There was an Asian population. I have to say, the Arab population didn't seem to participate in sport much, nor the African. There was a school and there was a pitch there, and the locals did produce a football team. Whether it was a local football club or not, I don't know. But we certainly had a couple of matches at least on the school football pitch. Perhaps more. I mean, because this was important. I mean, you know, getting friendly with the locals, which is what you're there to do, is achieved, you know, by games as much as anything. So we played football. The local, there was a club called the English Club, which was perhaps more of a dining club, so you could live there too. It was keen. It had a cricket team and a hockey team, and we played it certainly a couple of times. We had two cricket matches and several hockey games. And the Asian community, who were very sporty, had a very good going hockey club. There were a lot of Goans there too, who were very keen on hockey. And we played them a number of times, and we also played them football a number of times. So there was a lot of sport going on, and that was very good. And you know, after the game, we ensured that we provided a beer or two or something to eat, and we would meet up with the other side and some of their supporters, and it was all very friendly and very, very good public relations. And I think we were quite good at that, because you know, we were a very disciplined organisation, and but friendly too, and we enjoyed doing these things.
Did you take part in any of the sports?
I did, in all of them, football, hockey and cricket. Yes, I was very keen games player and took part in all of them, yes. Helped organise some of them too.
And you mentioned having a beer as well. Could you get something like a beer easily enough?
Yeah, we, with a, it's a funny thing, part of the general resupply of provisions, which again, as I said, came from, organised by East Africa Command in Nairobi, and therefore we were provisioned by the Royal Army Service Corps, who would put whatever provisions we needed on that ferry at Mombasa and would come and resupply us. And part of the resupply of food and provisions and anything else we needed, be it medical supplies or whatever, there was always the resupply done by NAFI. NAFI followed the military all around the world, and that would include our beer, because we had our NAFI tent, you know, which is a tent where the jocks, when they were off duty, could go and have a beer or buy something to eat. And so we had, and it was all duty free, of course, very, very cheap, and we could get certainly plenty of beer to entertain the teams we were playing, hockey or football.
And was there a restriction within the army, you know, about how much beer that someone could have per day or something like that?
Yeah, there always is. I mean, unless you relax the restriction, you know, if there's a particular occasion, then you would relax it, but otherwise or you're very careful about it, particularly when you are on an alert situation. And I can't remember what the ration was, but certainly no one would have exceeded it. I do remember later on in Borneo, for example, the ration was 2 cans of beer a week. But in the end, we didn't even ask for that amount to be delivered, because if all you're allowed is 2 cans a week, you know, you might as well not have any, and that was generally the view of most people. But Zanzibar would, I can't remember what the limit would have been, but it wouldn't have been as controlled as that, but it was probably 2 cans a day or something. And, you know, that was only if you were off duty, none at all if you were on duty.
How long would you have been on duty for at any one time? Would it have just been the 8 hours, or would it have been a longer one?
The 8 hour would be the patrol, and of course you were on duty for that, but of course there's getting ready for your patrol, and there's coming back from your patrol. You might be debriefing the platoon, you'd be cleaning your weapon, certainly would be happening after that. So there's a period, you know, of your 8 hours is probably 12 hours on duty, and then you're officially off duty, so to speak, unless told otherwise. If you might go from patrol onto sort of standby, in which case you're still on duty. But once officially off duty, then you were free to have a beer or whatever.
Okay. And you've mentioned sports, having contact with the locals. Was there any other ways that you would have contact with the locals? Would it have just been when you were out on patrol, or did they ever work in the camp?
No, we didn't have any local labour working in the camp. So contact with the locals would be just the sort of contact you'd make. You know, if you were off duty and if the hour was right, there was nothing to stop you walking into Zanzibar itself, which people did a great deal of, and that was as important as anything else. It was important that we should do that. The off-duty soldiers would certainly have gone into Zanzibar, because, you know, life can be a little tedious, staying 3 months totally in your tented camp. And so we did go into Zanzibar a lot and fraternize with the locals. I mean, there were cafes and bars usually run by Asians. They seem to run the economy in so many parts of the world because they're so hardworking and they have an aptitude for it. So we would certainly see our jocks, and we'd be there in favorite bars and cafes and round and about, walking through the bazaar, the shops, and you know, that was very, very good. It was good for the economy because we'd be spending money, but they would see that we weren't soldiers the whole time, that we were out and about and fraternizing.
Was there ever any trouble, you know, with the army being there?
No, I mean, there was no trouble on the part of the civilians. They were very pleased to see us, and certainly very pleased to see us spending money. And for our part, we had no reason to create trouble. And in fact, if anyone did, I mean, that was a very serious offence. Everyone knew precisely what the role was, and that was to be friendly and to mix and mingle. And if anyone stepped out of line, and perhaps as a result of one too many, you know, he was dealt with in uncertain times, because that's the last thing you want.
And were you still being briefed at this point about, you know, the situation in Zanzibar? Were you being kept fully informed?
Yes, we were. That was done on a daily basis, really, because if we weren't obtaining any information from our patrols, our company commander, Angus Tindall, was in close touch with not only the consulate there, but, well, it wasn't a consulate. Zanzibar was an entry protectorate of the UK. So he was being briefed through diplomatic sources, and he had regular daily meetings with the chief of police. So he was always very well informed as to what the political situation was. He would tell them what the military one was, and so we, from very early on, we were all well informed about the situation.
Okay. And you mentioned before as well, it was the Aga Khan's bungalow that you were living in.
That's right.
Did you say that you'd actually met him?
I didn't say that. No, he was the owner of this property, and it was a very suitable property for us because it was outside Zanzibar. Zanzibar is just a small town with very narrow streets and alleyways, and there was nowhere where you could really just dump a military unit who needs a little bit of space. This was ideal because it was only a mile out of town, so just a perfect distance to keep anyone at their distance, so to speak, and yet we were just seconds away. And it was a very useful building. He was had obviously been approached by the military authorities and was as far as I understand it, happy to release his property to the army for such time as it was necessary. So he removed all his possessions, and he had so many other places to live, I don't suppose he missed it.
I thought he maybe came down to some of the parades.
Oh, yes, no. No, I don't know. I don't even know where the Aga Khan lived. His main base might be in the Middle East somewhere, but it wasn't Zanzibar. This was just a holiday home for him.
Okay. No, was it in Zanzibar that you had this GOC parade?
No, the GOC did visit us, but General Goodwin was based in Nairobi. He visited us more than once. And we would have paraded for him, but it would have just been a company parade, not a hugely ceremonial affair. Now, we went there on ceremonial duties, and he could have whistled up as much as he wanted in the way of ceremony in Nairobi itself, where the guards and the statue regiment were based. No, but he only visited us a couple of times. We were also visited by Air Chief Marshal Elworthy, who was Commander-in-Chief of what are they called, not Middle East Forces, but it took in Aden, Cyprus, Kenya, and various other parts, I forget. He was CNC of that particular organisation, and he visited us too.
And was that in Zanzibar?
Yes.
Right, okay. Now, what about contact with home? Could you get contact with home when you were in Zanzibar?
By mail. That wasn't the day of the mobile phones, and indeed no other sort of phone would have got through, I don't think. So we had mail, and again the army, wherever it went, sets up British Forces post office, and that we had a special number, so anyone at home who wanted to write to us would just write to private, whatever it was, of 1st Battalion, the Gordon Handers, BFPO, whatever it was. And that would get to us within 5 days. Terrific system. Gilgil, where we were in Kenya, would have one number. Nairobi would have another number. Zanzibar immediately got its number, and the mail worked perfectly. And we had the mail system going out too, and we had our post room in company headquarters, and anyone who wanted to hand in a letter would just hand it in, and would be taken away that day in about 5 days, or perhaps it was a bit longer, perhaps seven, but it was a very good system. And it was back home in Scotland, delivered to parents' house and within a week.
Okay. And was there any form of censorship within the mail system?
Absolutely not. No. Not at all. And, of course, one of the duties of a platoon commander was to make sure that everyone did write a letter, and it didn't have to be once a week, but certainly you had to make sure that contact was being made, because, you know, the average age was very low. I mean, there were very young people serving out there, away from home for the first time, many of them. So, the likelihood was that parents back home in Aberdeenshire or wherever would be a little worried about them. And so it's always reassuring to get a letter, no matter how short, just to say everything's okay and that we made sure it happened. But absolutely no censorship. They just wrote a letter, sealed the envelope, put a stamp on, and off it went.
And how did you encourage a young man to write this letter? You know, did you ever have difficulty?
Yes. Oh, yes, because, you know, I have to say, as a young man myself, I wasn't a very good correspondent, so you know, I knew what it was like to have to sit down and write something. But the encouragement was really following my own practice. You know, if you write short but often, that's absolutely fine at home. They get used to the idea that you're busy and you're this and you're that, and you're also a bit lazy when it comes to letter writing. But if they get 5 or 6 lines every fortnight, that'll cheer up home no end. And so we just used to concentrate on that. Just keep it very short and do it, you know, very often. And that was the way of encouraging them, because anyone can sit down and write 3 or 4 lines.
And were you enjoying this experience as well that you were having in Zanzibar?
Oh, yes. I'm just loving it. Yes. A job to do, as we've said, it turned out it wasn't a serious military operation at all. It was just keeping the peace, and that's precisely what we did. I think you have to look at it, you know, had we not been there, would there have been peace? And I think the answer is probably not. So we were doing a useful job, and you were aware of that. And the very fact that there was communication between, you know, the diplomatic sources, the police, and ourselves made it interesting, and it was just fascinating, a terrific way of getting into the army, which is what I was doing. This was my first posting.
Okay. And you've described a lot of the island to us. You know, you've spoken about the sea, the golf course, the beach and that. What like was the overall island? Was it hilly or flat?
It was, yes, pretty flat and fairly barren. Some of it was cultivated, but, you know, such was the poverty of the island. You know, there was no real farming equipment or anything, so if a person didn't do it with a hoe and a rake, he didn't have anything else available to him. So part of it was cultivated, but not good quality produce, and the rest was pretty barren. Lush enough, as I said before, you know, so there clearly was a rainfall that sufficient at one time of the year to look after the soil and make sure it remained soil and not sand. But it was narrow, it was just a poor island. But no, it was flat, not hilly.
And for the 3 months that you were there, did you get leave, or was it just you were expected to work 3 months?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, the latter. There was no leave. As I said, we had off-duty moments, but that's not a whole day. I mean, you might have a whole day off or something, but there was no leave during that time.
Okay. So, and when you went there, did you know that you were only going for 3 months?
Yep. That was the program. A company had been there for 3 months, and I was with B company, and we were there for 3 months, and D company followed us, and they did the same.
Okay. So as it was coming up towards your three-month period, did you know where you were going then?
Yes, going back to battalion. The rest of the battalion, you see, there for the bulk of it, was in Gilgil in Kenya. Battalion headquarters, headquarter company, and the other two rifle companies. So there was just one rifle company down in Zanzibar at any one time. So we knew at the end of our three-month spell we were going back to Gilgil.
Were you looking forward to this?
Yeah, I certainly was, because, you know, it was going to be joining the main body again, and that was good. And but I was very sorry to leave Zanzibar. We'd made friends with some very good people, and